Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Thompson, whose latest book is The Whole Equation, subtitled The History of Hollywood, which is not really what it is. It's an essay about Hollywood and its effect on America and America and Los Angeles' effect on Hollywood. Book-length essay. Also author of The New Biographical Dictionary of Film, just out in trade paper, an enormous compilation, much of it very personal to David Thompson, which sets it apart from many books with similar kinds of titles, which is a fascinating thing. You can dip into it and just read it any time. Let's talk first a little bit about The Whole Equation. At the end of an interview I read for the Biographical Dictionary of Film, you had talked about wanting to write this book. Had you already begun it at that point?
Yes. When the last edition of the Biographical Dictionary came out in 2002, I was launched on The Whole Equation. I knew I was going to do it. I'd been thinking about it for probably a couple of years, and I think I started writing it when the dictionary was published, you know, after the tour that went with the dictionary.
The book itself, it's not quite a history. It's more just ruminations on the history set in a kind of chronological time frame. Was it a problem figuring out what to leave in or what to leave out?
What you put in and what you leave out, in a way, is the definition of writing. This was a case where those decisions were especially challenging because you say it's not a history book, but it's a book that deals with history.
Sure.
And I did want to give the reader a sense of the main arc of what has happened with Hollywood, and I equally knew I did not want to write a book that described Hollywood year by year in a sort of dogged, monotonous way. So I judged that what I had to do was to pick upon the sort of critical nodal points in the history, and I made a selection of those. And that selection changed a bit as the book went along, I remember, because I felt the need to balance it a little bit differently. So, you know, a few things were dropped, a few things were put in late in the day, and I was playing around with the order of the chapters because they don't run directly, smoothly, chronologically. I would say the crucial issue was really, what does one take to be the most important things historically that have happened there?
The whole equation, it's my sense that when you're talking about what the whole equation is, you're talking about the balance of art and commerce. But there's more to it than that. It's also the relationship of movies to society. It seems to me that the only way true art comes out of that balance is through some kind of luck, I guess.
Accident.
And the difference, I think, between Hollywood and the rest of art is that Hollywood is a collaborative effort, or film itself is a collaborative effort that costs an enormous amount of money.
Yeah. A big reason for writing this book is my ongoing puzzlement over the question, is film an art form? And I have the personal history of a kid who fell in love with film, thought that's what I wanted to do, and probably because I was pretentious and ambitious in the right ways, I thought, well, if I want to do it, film must be an art form, you know. Now, there's no question, and we all know, I think, that certain films do get very close to being art, even if they're not quite there. But the huge majority of films do not get close to being art. They are something else. And I think that they can be enormously good entertainment without being art. And one of the things that I think comes out of this that's important is to distinguish success from virtue. And, you know, it is a recurring American problem, I think, today in many other walks of life than just looking at the movies, to say that because a thing is successful, it must be great. Don't think it's true. America is successful. Doesn't mean it's great. Doesn't mean there's not tremendous room for self-criticism in and about America. And in many ways, I look back on the history of film and have the feeling that it's done nearly as much damage as it's done good. It's entertained us, and I think there are great moments like the Second World War when it really helped bring the people together. and where there was something in the entertainment value that was morale building, was reassuring, and was valuable. But I equally think that the movies have contributed enormously to an insane pursuit of a thing called happiness that is really barely distinguishable from what advertising does to us. And, you know, advertising as we now know it would not be what it is but for Hollywood and the movies. All ads, all television commercials are tiny movies. Of those things, I'm enormously critical and enormously worried. I have youngest children, enormously worried about what has happened educationally in a world where people are stopping reading. It's not just that they're not interested in history, but they believe that to keep in touch with the world is a matter of watching television.
There's actually, I stopped at one point, it was on page 295 of The Whole Equation, because it suddenly hit me that you'd hit something here. If you go to the bottom of page 295 and just read from the words, our education.
Our education is still largely based on what words mean, how they fit together grammatically. Against that, how many of us have ever had any education in the nature of moving imagery, its grammar, its laws or lawlessness, or how the naive viewer is expected to distinguish news from fantasy, art from deception?
And I think to me that paragraph is a key to what you're talking about here, which is we've never been trained to recognize Fox News, for example.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, we sort of take it for granted after so many decades of movies that kids know how it's done. You talk to them in detail. They don't. And that means that they don't really understand the ease with which that medium can trick them, can deceive them. And we're in an age now where it's relatively easy for people to fabricate and concoct imagery in the way that John Hartfield did in the 30s of using photo montage, where it was very clear that he was putting things together. Now it can be done seamlessly, you know. I mean, you've seen Forrest Gump. A shot of, let us say, one politician shaking hands with another politician, which could be enormously damaging, could be managed technically so that nobody watching would assume but that it was a proper piece of film that recorded a reality. That's an enormously dangerous situation.
David Thompson, I came up with three areas that you kind of tangentially cover, but to me, they're more central, and I want to ask you one in particular, which is so central for me, and I'll explain why, that it seems like its loss seems to me a gap, and that's the actual effect of the code from mid-1934 on, because I have been doing a study on my own with a friend of mine, taping old movies off Turner Classics and then watching pre-code, and the difference between movies from 1929, when the silence and talkies came in, up to mid-34, to what happened after 34, is like night and day.
Well, I think that's a very fair point. I would accept that it's an area that I could have dealt with in more depth. I mean, I think there is a frankness, a candor, there's a willingness to accept certain kinds of material in some of those early films, not all of them, obviously. And I think early sound was a very interesting experimental period. I would not dispute your point that in the overall space of my book I may have neglected that a bit. I wouldn't argue with that.
Because of that, there's less emphasis on the relationship, I think, of the censorship of 1934 to, say, 64 on American society. That candor, openness, and honesty, you know, from the films of Richard Barthelmess on a political end to even Norma Shearer's sex pot stuff at the other end, that being missing created this fantasy world that could never relate to the real world we were living in.
Well, I think I differ with you a little bit there, because I don't think adherence to the pre-code circumstances that you're talking about and which produced some very interesting things, I don't think that would have done anything to eliminate or reduce significantly the fantasy element in film. I think the fantasy feeling, the encouragement to the audience and to the American people, the people of the world, to look at lifelike dreams and to sort of participate in them vicariously as a way to offset the harsh, difficult circumstances of their real life, which I think politically one can easily say has been a disastrous thing. I think that would have happened anyway. And you can go to countries where there was never the kind of prudish censorship of film that we had in this country, like France. And I still think that the element of fantasy has become dominant because it's in the very nature of the circumstances of watching film. There we are in the dark, anonymous, unknown, peeping Toms who will never be identified, picked out. The spotlight never comes on us. We never have a guilty finger saying, what are you doing watching right. this in the dark? We are encouraged to participate vicariously, which I think, and this I do talk about, I think that leads to a very significant gradual separation or loss of responsibility for reality. And that's a huge, huge thing.
But that would be around the world as a whole.
I think it's there in the nature of film. I think it's there in the nature of television, too. And in that respect, you know, I do see television as a sort of natural continuation of film by somewhat different means.
I also would throw in that it's hard to tell what kind of difference America had in terms of those 30 years when you've got films in which the adulterer never, you know, never has a happy ending, where everyone gets punished, where obviously married people sleep in separate beds, and where we wind up with today is from the extreme right this idea that America in the 50s or 40s was kind of idyllic in a way it never was.
Yes, except that I don't buy that portrait you've just painted. It's there. Elements of it are there. But I think, and again, I do talk about this a great
deal. Oh, yeah.
One of the most interesting things that happened, I think, is that right at the end of the Second World War, at a moment when more people went to the movies than have ever gone in this country, there was an extraordinary breakthrough of reality onto the screen. We call it film noir. It's a very suddenly dark vision. And, you know, you can ascribe it to all manner of things. But this was not a defeated country. It was beginning to become a very prosperous country because, really, the Depression was over, apart from the war being over. I think the impact of things like nuclear weapons and the revelation of what had happened in the concentration camps, and also the sort of total insight into just how depraved and cruel human beings could be, these seem to me to be inescapable things. And for a few years, in the late 40s, in the film noir, a lot of very dark things happen.
Oh, yeah.
People get away with dark stuff, and you know, it's not strictly true what you say about it being a very clear vision. And I think one of the great tragedies is the way in which Hollywood, beginning to deal again, if you like, with adult material, was frightened off by the whole House Un-American Activities Committee. I take that to be a devastating blow at which Hollywood colluded in its own tragedy and failure, because I think clearly if the Hollywood studios had been grown up and united and as strong as they might have been, I believe they could have said to the government, oh, don't be silly. Come on. Obey the law, you know.
Well, this was one of, I think, when I saw The Aviator, one of the things I didn't realize is when Howard Hughes told off that committee that was investigating him, the scene in the film, in the Scorsese film, actually comes from real life. So it was possible for them to just, you know, do what Woody Allen does at the end of The Front.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know the details of this, and many of your listeners will, but we all remember the way certain people on the stand in front of the McCarthyist tribunals took the Fifth Amendment. But originally, there was a much more interesting determination by the people who felt threatened by this, and we're talking about the period from 47 on, which was to take the First Amendment, claim the First Amendment right, which I think, legally, was much more interesting, much more valid. And also, in terms of just performance in the courts, would put you in a much better situation, which is to stand up in America and say, all right, I believe in communism. Am I not allowed to? You know, is this not a legitimate thing? There was an attempt. A group of Hollywood people flew to Washington, a much publicized event.
And that's in your book.
Yeah. And they all climbed down. And that was disastrous. And they climbed down because they were pressured. But, again, I do not blame just the individuals. These were not politically very sophisticated or very brave people, and they had a lot to lose. But I blame the studios. The studios, I think, could have gathered together and said, this is a nonsense. Stop it. Go and pick on someone else.
But there's also the case, and I think Neil Gabler makes the case in his book from several years ago about how the Jews created Hollywood, David Thompson, that in fact there was an underlying anti-Semitism that scared the hell out of the studio owners because this came on the heels of the Holocaust.
I think that, you know, this is an absolutely vital point, and I agree totally, and I think that the insecurity of Jewish businessmen who had built this industry and who had really transformed their own circumstances. You know, I mean, a man like Louis B. Mayer had gone from real poverty, harsh, tough poverty, to being maybe the highest paid man in America. And there was always in that first generation of Jews who had founded Hollywood the terror, I think, that the movies would be attacked in part as a sort of Jewish plot against the wholesomeness of America. And the truth of the matter is, that, as anyone old enough will attest to, anti-Semitism in this country, in Britain where I come from, in the 20s and the 30s, was a fairly evident thing. People didn't bother to hide it. It was reckoned to be a natural way of thinking. And so, you know, I think there were grounds, there were reasons why these people were afraid. That still does not excuse them.
The other things that it seems that are touched on tangentially, but I think are more central,
mm-hmm.
One of them, again, you touch on with Jaws, which is the move to summer movies and the younger generation coming in. It seems to me that what you don't quite get to, which is on the Star Wars thing, the idea of the tent poles and the summer movie just completely overwhelming Hollywood output.
Well, I mean, there, I'm sorry to hear you say that, because I thought I had dealt with that, because I, in part, I guess, it's because I lived through it.
Feel so obvious, yeah. And self-evident, yeah.
No, I think you're correct. That just as in the early 70s, there was a tremendous run of really interesting movies, and not unlike those movies of the 1940s in that they were taking on darker subjects, and, you know, Michael Corleone kills his own brother, but survives. And we're left in a world where Michael Corleone and Noah Cross in Chinatown are there, in charge. And it's a, you know, it's a pretty clear comment on how America functions. Just at that time, the industry regains its confidence because Spielberg and Lucas, and obviously there was no design in this, but they, in effect, reinvented an audience, a young audience that would go to the movies uncritically. And we still are living in the era of that young audience. It's not significantly altered.
Oh, I think it's worse now.
Except that its standards have declined. I mean, right. Jaws looks like a pretty good film compared with a lot of what we get today. But no, I agree totally that the business was altered, and it turned into a business aimed at a very small section of the audience, which means a lot of other people who have been alienated by the movies. A lot of older people who are not old feel they don't make movies for me anymore. And there's a lot of truth in it.
The corollary of that, David Thompson, is that the movies that have to be seen on the big screen, now we can argue about whether, you know, a small movie needs to be seen on the big screen or not, and, you know, rather than sitting at home with your DVD or your VCR or just watching a film. But the big movies, the epics, there used to at least be the intelligent epic. Now, in the whole equation, you downgrade Spartacus, which I really, you know, I think is a great film. But you do talk about Lawrence of Arabia and some of the other epics of the era. It seems that now, in the past few years, the adult epic, whether a success or failure, We only had two last year, which were Master and Commander and Cold Mountain. This year we only have the Aviator. What's going on? Is it completely disappearing?
I think what has always been true is an epic does not depend on big effects, crowd scenes, spectacular recreations of famous battles. Those are important, but they're not the central thing. The central thing is a story in which I think you face a critical moment of history. Now, Lawrence of Arabia, I think, is dated very badly in the sense that we now know that the modern Iraq emerged from those maneuvers, and you'd much rather hear how that happened. But, you know, I mean, epics like El Cid, if you remember, there was the confrontation of the Spaniards and the Moors, a very big historical issue. You take an event of this year, Alexander the Great. In Alexander the movie, there is no sense of some really important historical confrontation. In Troy, which I thought was nearly as bad as Alexander, I mean, in Master and Commander, you do have a feeling, I think, of what men of that time, the Napoleonic Right. War, what they felt life was about. I thought in Gladiator a few years ago, well, I didn't like it as much as some people, still, the notions of different definitions of freedom within the Roman society were there in the film, you know, and it didn't really cheat Roman history too much. I just think we are not having people contribute to epics who are aware of what they're about. I mean, it goes back to a very old thing. There has hardly ever been an American film, let alone a good American film, about the War of Independence. That's unbelievable. You know, I mean, that is the thing. That is our founding moment. Good God, could it make a great film? Of course it could. And yet I don't think we are a society anymore that cares enough about history, probably. I mean, that's a big part of it, I think.
Well, the old line, which I think Gore Vidal first used, the United States of amnesia.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
You're listening to an interview with David Thompson, whose new book is The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. David Thompson, the current audience in movie theaters is so awful, so loud, so obnoxious, so used to living in their living room, that for most people it destroys the experience.
Well, again, I agree with you, and I think it's a tragedy. I talk in the book about what it was like to go to movies at the end of the war and early on, when to be in an audience in those days, I took and remember as a sort of metaphor for being part of a society. I mean, it was the first time, I think, that I ever found myself with a mass of strangers. And people watched with great earnestness, and they were respectful of the film, and they laughed together, and they cried together sometimes. And I think those are very valuable things. To be in an audience can be a quite wonderful thing. And I agree with you today. I think that the kids who go to the theaters believe that the movie theater is their place, their playground almost, and they often treat it like that. They go in and out of films, and the narratives on our films allow them to do it. They can say, take 10 minutes. We're not going to do anything in the story. You come back in 10 minutes' time, you'll be okay. You won't have lost anything. And they come back with more food and that kind of thing. You know, people talk in theaters. They're asked to turn their cell phones off, but they don't always. The audience has become a rowdy, selfish, much less pleasant group to be in. I mean, go to a theater, go to a concert, and you can immediately make contact again with that rather more old-fashioned sense of audience. And it's as encouraging and it's as rewarding as ever. No, we are used to watching movies in our living room doing a lot of other things, and a lot of people who go to the theater believe that you can do a lot of other things.
David Thompson, what do you think, if any, the effect of the MTV cutting and moving around, the two-minute video has on movies, or is it just simply because ads have gotten in that direction that movies have changed?
Well, it's a whole lot of things that have done it. I mean, the power of editing is famously one of the things that is powerful in films. I think all of these things, the fragmentation, the sort of spurious excitement of it all, take away from the most fruitful style in film, which I always think is long takes, moving camera, the use of real space. you know, the things that a lot of directors of the 30s and 40s were exploring and working out, and I still think is the most beautiful kind of film ever made. In this light, when Carson died, I saw a thing on the Charlie Rose show where Charlie Rose was talking to Conan O'Brien, I think, and O'Brien said that Carson was a man who could have a quiet conversation. You can't have a quiet conversation. The conversation has to get jazzy. It has to get belligerent. It has to get stupid. People have to get up and do handstands. They don't trust the audience any longer to follow, you know, a steady two people over a cup of coffee mulling over an idea. The thing radio does, the thing we're trying to do here. Television has got terrible predisposition to edge towards the frantic. And, you know, Carson now looks like a much wiser man than I think he really was, because he listened to people.
Well, it kind of goes beyond that. I mean, there are elements on television, The Sopranos, which treat television like film.
HBO is the greatest film studio in the world at the moment, I think.
I used to love musicals, and to me, the idea that someone is dancing, Hermes Pan and Fred Astaire worked out how to film a dance in 1933, they seem to have forgotten.
But you show the whole figure when you show
yeah,
a dance.
And long
and
takes.
And you move the camera as the person's moving. Right. I agree. And, you know, if you go back to those pictures at RKO in the late 30s and the MGM musical, you'll see the same principles. And nowadays, no one understands. You cut to close-ups of the feet and that kind of thing. And they're ruination. Ruination.
Let's talk a little, David Thompson, about the new Biographical Dictionary of Film. As I was dipping into it, I came across two figures, French directors, one of whom I've been obsessed with lately, the other whom I've never heard of. So let's talk first about the one I've never heard of, Jacques Rivette. Who is Jacques Rivette?
Well, Jacques Rivette was one of the French New Wave directors. I mean, he was a writer, a critic at Cahiers du Cinéma through the 1950s. And if you collected Cahiers du Cinéma in those days, you were reading Jacques Rivette very often. And he was one of the more interesting critics. And he came along at the time of Godard and Truffaut and started making films then. And he's still making films. He's quite an elderly man now. But he's still working, still makes films. And over the years, he has made several films which I really think are masterpieces. L'Amour Fou would be one of them. And a film of his that is in my top 10 of all time, called Celine and Julie Go Boating.
Which is not available on DVD because I looked.
No, but it's on video. It's on video. I rented it myself recently. You can get it still. Not on DVD, no. That is an absolutely superb picture about narrative, really. That's its own subject.
The one I've been obsessed with lately is Jean Renoir, who I discovered, I mean, yeah, I've seen Grand Illusion many, many years ago, and when the three set of his late French films, mid-French films, Golden Coach, yeah, when those came out, I watched those, and since then I've kind of expanded, and I had never seen Rules of the Game, which just blew me away.
Well, Jean Renoir, in my opinion, is the greatest film director of all time. I mean, that's a silly thing to say because it doesn't really mean very much beyond my owning up to personal favoritism. But I could argue the case. I could argue that, I mean, there's a man who began in the silent era, obviously was the son of the great painter, and didn't really start making films until the late 60s. He started making films right after the First World War.
Okay, the late 20s.
Yeah, well, early 20s even.
Okay.
I think in terms of intricate style and developed humanism, unrivaled. I mean, just magnificent. And I can easily understand how you could become obsessed with him. And I don't think, I would say this, I don't think there's another director for whom that obsession is worthier. When I was a teacher of film at Dartmouth, I taught a seminar on Renoir, and it was one of the happiest teaching experiences I ever had. The kids just went increasingly excited over the films.
Well, Rules of the Game, as I was watching it, I kept thinking, this is Gosford Park without the murder.
And
this is Altman.
Well, Altman, I think, knows Renoir well. I mean, the moving camera, the use of deep space, the use of many people in the frame at the same time so that you're watching lots of different strands of action. It's very common to both of them,
An amazing director. Would you say Rules of the Game, then, is his best film? I mean, if you're looking for the best.
Yes, I mean, I think that, it comes at a critical moment. It's the last film he made in France before the war broke out, and he left France right after that. It was a complete failure, of course, when it came out. It is one of those films that has survived its own box office failure. I think if you had time before the bomb goes off to see one Renoir film, I would say see Rules of the Game. But you have time to see many more.
Right. Well, French Can-Can also just
astonishing,
magnificent film.
Beautiful film.
You know, after seeing something like Moulin Rouge, and not that there's anything wrong with Moulin Rouge.
But I mean, he is a great, great director, and I think I met him briefly. I've read the book he wrote about his father. He wrote a novel. He wrote an autobiography. He wrote lots of letters. I've read all those things, and I can only tell you that the more you study him, the more you come to love him.
The DVDs of many of these contain little bits and pieces of interviews that are fabulous.
Yes.
Absolutely wonderful.
Well, of course, he's an actor in Rules of the Game, and you can tell, I think, from that film alone what an extraordinarily convivial and supportive man he was. He loved people, and I think in the end, that's what his films are about.
David Thompson, the new biographical dictionary of film contains a lot of people in it, but some are left out, meaning that you had to make those decisions, and a lot of them have to be borderline.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in a way, it's one of the self-imposed trials of my life, which I never guessed at or realized. But yeah, I mean, it's a big book. It's nearly 1,000 pages now, and there are an awful lot of people in it. But there are people left out.
Alexander Payne.
Well, yes, and he should be in the book. I do not leave people out often for any reason other than just the problems of space and time. I get a lot of letters from people were sending me lists of people they think should be in the book, and I can only assure the writers of those letters that I keep them. Every time a new edition comes up, I get them out and I go through them and I make lists. And the editor of the book, Bob Gottlieb and I, he's been the editor now for two editions, we sit down and we really do everything we can. We would love to get everyone in, but it is a book now that is quite a handful to hold, and it's obviously quite a handful to print and bind. I don't want it to go to two volumes. I don't want this to be a two-volume book. And there will be another edition, all being well. And there will be probably, at the time of the new edition, at least another 150 people in there. And if you have your cases, I mean, I will tell you here and now that Alexander Payne will be in.
Oh, sure.
That's a surefire. But also, one of the most interesting parts of the book is going back and repairing previous holes from the past. And I almost take more pleasure in filling some of those old gaps than the new ones. So encourage people to write to the publisher or write to me, and we'll do our best. But there will still be people left out.
Oh, sure. And of course, there are reappraisals. Julia Roberts goes up a few notches.
Yes.
Who do you think comes down?
Well, there was a time in my life when I was really deeply in love with the films of Nicholas Ray. And I knew him a bit in the last years of his life, which were appallingly chaotic and tragic. And he was easy to love because he was so self-destructive. I look at the films again and I think they're not quite as good as I thought they were. And it is a big part of this book that I review the films as much as I can. And as you grow older, films change. You're changing, obviously. The films are the same. But your feeling for them changes, and you see different things in them. And I think now that Lubitsch is a lot better than I did when I did the first edition. And there were several cases like that. There will be some reappraisals next time around, yeah.
Do you think there's any great undiscovered or minimally discovered filmmaker, someone we don't recognize as great now, of the 30s, 40s, 50s?
Yeah, I do. There's a famous case in the film history books of a man named Gustav Mahaty, a Czech director. He is famous in the books because he directed a film called Ecstasy, the one with Hedy Lamarr when she was very young, when her name was Hedy Kiesler. She was Austrian. And the film is famous because there's a quite extended nude sequence in the film when she was a very beautiful woman. And there is even a scene in the film where she has an orgasm in close-up. Now, that man, Mahaty, I had not been able to see any of his films until the last 10 years. And he is a really interesting director. He is not just the maker of a sexy band film. I'm certain that if one was to go to Japan and had the time to say to the archive, show me everything you've got, I suspect there are some figures in Japan who, if we knew, would look pretty good, and we don't know. So, yeah, I think there are people. I mean, there's an English director named Robert Hamer. You may or may not have heard of him. He did Kind Hearts and Coronets. That's the film you may know. He did several other films that I think are absolutely first class. And, yeah, there are plenty of people that even the film-going public, the people, even film buffs, need to catch up on. Yeah.
Which, luckily, we could do now through DVD and...
We're in a happy situation because, you know, when I started this book, it was before video, and it was literally very, very difficult to see a lot of films. That's a forgotten age, almost.
I've talked to several people. Roger Ebert was one, and I forgot who the other was. I think Mick LaSalle of the Chronicle.
Yeah.
Who said that the only proper way to see films, and it's not that expensive, is to get a projection TV and a little screen in your living room. Do you think that's true?
No, I'm not crazy about watching films on your own. I mean, it's a very clean and easy method. I like to see films in big theaters.
Going over to Pacific Film Archive of the Castro Theater.
At this very moment, I'm programming a season at the PFA and the old Castro, which I hope will continue to be as good as it always has been. Yeah, I love big screens. I love the face to be as big as the side of a house.
David Thompson, you talk about important films in the history of Los Angeles, and you mentioned Chinatown, which we all know, but you also mentioned another film, which when I saw it, I didn't look at the special effects. I thought, my God, this is a political film about Los Angeles, and that was Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is about the destruction of the trolleys.
Well, I mean, curiously enough, when Robert Towne did Chinatown, when he wrote it, he had a dream of doing three films, and the third of them was going to be set in the 50s, and it was about the withdrawal of the red cars and you know, the whole way in which the transportation system in L.A. was manipulated. And, of course, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a lovely, brilliant study on that very same issue. Yeah, yeah. I like that film very much, by the way.
Yeah, I do, too.
I think it's beautifully done. Very funny, very clever.
Well, speaking of that, are there any almost subversive political films that we can look for that have been around that we never look at from that angle that you can think of other than Roger Rabbit?
Well, yeah, I'm sure there are. You caught me off guard with that question. But, well, are there any subversive films? Well, yeah, I mean, I think so. I'll go to a very obvious one because I think it's a very mysterious film. The Godfather. Is The Godfather a story about how wicked organized crime is and how we should eliminate the mafia? Or is The Godfather a film that leaves you wishing you were part of that family? I think both strands are there, and, you know, very complicated film.
David Thompson, in all of your research, okay, in all of those years, who is the person you'd most like to have known and the person that, you know, you'd least like to have been in a room with?
Oh, the person I would most like to have met and known, in the sense that I could meet him often and talk, would have been Orson Welles, without a doubt. I think that he was one of the most thoroughly educated, self-educated but worldly and witty and knowing man who've ever been part of film. And I think he would have frustrated me and driven me crazy and made me angry a lot, but I would love to have known him. I mean, whom I would not have liked to have met. Well, okay, I'll give you an answer. I mean, it comes to me quickly. I would be very afraid to meet someone like Greta Garbo and discover that she was horribly dull. Because, you know, we dream that people like Garbo are infinitely magical. I suspect, I taught Greta Garbo's great niece at Dartmouth, and the great niece was fond of her great aunt, but she did confide to me that the woman was not quite the woman on screen.
I remember interviewing Don Bacardi, yeah, who was Christopher Isherwood's partner, and
yes,
he said once Garbo came to visit, and he looked out the window, and there she was walking up the steps, and she was in color.
Yeah.
And he'd never seen that. And none of us have ever seen Garbo in color.
She never made a color film, no.
David Thompson, what are you working on now?
Well, I finished a novel last year. I have not written any fiction for quite some time. It's a novel that I'm very committed to and quite pleased with it. I don't think it's quite right yet, but it needs some more work. But I'm very hopeful that it will come out quite soon. And I would like to write some more fiction. I had done in the past, but I had to support a family, and nonfiction supports a family rather better than fiction, or at least the fiction I write.
We have the Oscars coming up.
Yeah.
First of all, two quick questions. An appraisal of Oscars, should we care?
No.
Okay.
We should be much smarter and wiser.
But we do care. Well, why do we care?
Well, because they tell us to care, and they promote themselves with so much money. And in the end, on the night, we say, oh, come on, let's watch, because they're going to make fools of themselves. And, you know, we want to see the dresses and the flesh, and we want to hear the jokes. And I mean, it's one of those very silly things to which we are addicted. There are some other things to which we're addicted that are a good deal more dangerous, I think. You know, it's harmless. It's a little bit like sporting events. I mean, need we care about the Super Bowl? No, but a lot of us will watch.
Well, the other thing is that in the end, it's a crapshoot whether the film will be remembered,
yes,
or not.
The silly thing, of course, is to say that because they gave it a statuette, it was the best picture or whatever. That's the crazy thing. And Rules of the Game did not get nominated. Citizen Kane did not win. You know, and you can go back, and Charles Laughton's The Night of the Hunter did not get nominated. A lot of films that we now treasure never got nominated. And just among directors, Chaplin, Lubitsch, Hitchcock, Hawks, Altman, Preston Sturges, never won an Oscar for directing.
And if Scorsese wins this year, it won't be for his best film.
No, certainly not. But he clearly deserves something because of what he's done in the past.
Right. It's kind of a strange thing because we treat it as a joke and yet we treat it seriously.
That's the thing. Yeah, we get, you know, it's like supporting a football team when you know how silly it is. It's only a game. But, you know, if it's the 49ers, say, or whatever, you care a lot. We invest in silly things.
Obviously, I could go on forever, but another question. I was reading your bit on Almodovar and in New Biographical Dictionary, and you didn't rate him that highly.
No, I think that's a reappraisal. Jew, I think he's been improving steadily, and I agree with you. I think my piece in that book, which was written maybe 10 years ago, it needs serious revision, I think.
David Thompson, author of The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood, and the New Biographical Dictionary of Film, updated even from 2 years ago.
The paperback is updated.
And that's out in trade paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.